Great pleasure to have today's speaker, Professor Robert Hau from Harvard. He is Gordon MacKay Professor there, and he's heading Biorobotics Laboratory since 1990. And his research interests are on manipulation, sense of touch, and human machine interfaces. So he got his PhD in bachelor's in physics, and then PhD in mechanical engineering from Stanford. And he has been at Harvard from 1990. So it's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ben. And I appreciate the invitation. It's also exciting to visit the Robotics Institute at CMU because most places you visit, there are a couple of robotics people, and then you spend a good part of the day talking to the people who do material science or dynamics or something, and here it's all robots all the time. I love it. So let me tell you a little about a large project I've been involved with a number of people in the Boston area on intracardiac surgery. And the idea here is that we want to fix structures inside the heart. And this is in contrast to bypass surgery, probably the most common cardiac procedure, where you're trying to fix blood vessels on the outer surface of the heart. And a couple of things that are commonly done are atrial septal defect. So you'll forgive me if I step through a quick sort of anatomy of the heart here. The idea is that blood comes back from the body on the right side here, comes into the atrium, sent into the ventricle. The thick muscular walls here are the big pump. And that blood is then sent out to the lungs. It comes back from the lungs here into the left atrium, oxygenated. The left atrium shoves it into the left ventricle, which again is the big pump that sends it out to the rest of the body. And the atrial septal defect here is a hole you see here. And the problem is that this hole is open before birth when the lungs aren't really doing anything in the womb, but it's supposed to close, and it doesn't in a significant fraction of people, with the result that the oxygenated blood that should be sent around to the body instead gets shunted back to the right side. And this can lead to problems because the pressure on this side is a great deal higher than the pressure on this side, so there can be developmental problems with the heart. And the fix is very simple. The surgeons have to go through the open heart procedure, meaning they stop the heart, crack open the chest, and simply sew a small patch over the hole. And the actual patching part is pretty easy. But getting there, of course, is a very involved process. Another class of common intracardiac procedures are valve repair or replacement. Valves, especially the mitral valve here, sort of the main valve for the heart, can develop problems. There's something like 60,000 procedures a year in the US done on that valve. And again, it requires this open heart procedure where the heart is stopped and empty, and the heart-lung machine is doing the job of circulating the blood and oxygenating it. Now, this is a great development, last roughly 50 years. It saved many lives. However, it's increasingly clear that the use of that machine has some problems associated with it. For instance, inserting the large tubes that carry the blood to and from the machine can damage the vessels. All this manipulation of the vessels can cause strokes, can cause blood clots to form, which can affect the brain. And then finally, it's increasingly clear there's some problems with cognitive deficit. So this means, depending on the study you look at, something like a quarter or a third of the patients who undergo open heart surgery aren't quite as smart on the other side of the procedure. There are problems with decreased ability to form new memories, learn new motor patterns, and that sort of thing. So while it saves lives, it'd obviously be nice to avoid those complications. And the idea here is to do beating heart surgery inside the heart. Now, since the heart is full of blood, video is not an option. You can't see through blood. But fortunately, just in the last few years, there are new real-time 3D ultrasound machines. And this means instead of a slice like a conventional ultrasound machine, these devices can scan out an entire 3D volume 25 or 30 times a second. And then this can be displayed, and based on that information, it's possible to interact with structures in the heart in real time. Now, there are a bunch of challenges here. We'll go through in a second. But here are a couple of pictures to give you some idea of what these machines can see. This is the mitral valve here. You can see the two leaflets flapping open and closed as the ventricle contracts. And this is an atrial septal defect. In a human patient, it's been cropped down. And what you see is the hole here between the right and left sides. And we're flipping it over to show that it really is a three-dimensional image there. Okay, so the first procedure we tackled then with this new visualization technology is repairing that atrial septal defect, the simple hole between the right and left sides. And the approach, which the surgeon suggested and kind of amazed me, but in fact they were right, it works fine, they do this kind of thing with some regularity, is to actually insert instruments through the atrial wall using ports that prevent blood from coming out and ideally air from getting in as well, and then develop specialized instruments. So a patch deployment device here and an anchor driver here. And the way those work is like so. The patch deployment device is inserted as a straight rod, and then from the center of it, you push and out comes this coiled perimeter with the patch in between. And the patch is usually something like a simple Dacron cloth. On the other piece of equipment we need then is the anchor driver. And here's a picture of that. Here's a time sequence showing how the anchors are deployed. It's a hollow tube, actually a large hypodermic needle. And in it are these little omega-shaped staples, if you will, or anchors. The points are inside the tube until you start pushing in the drive rod. Then they come out and they hook into the tissue to more or less permanently anchor in place. However, it is easy to remove these. You have a little hook-shaped tool that then grabs the protruding loop, pulls it back into the tube, and you just reverse this process. The little points are just pulled back in. Surgeons are always worried about the ability to back out of what they've gotten themselves into.
It seems to me you're putting the patch on the downstream side of the hole where it's pushed away rather than the upstream where the pressure helps it. Why is that?
A bunch of reasons, mostly clinical. One is the access from the right side is easier. So in terms of getting to it, I should add that the procedures I'll describe today, we're currently doing beating heart, but the plan is to do them open chest, meaning you may still open the sternum in order to get access to the heart. However, in the long term, you'd like to be able to do this in a minimally invasive way, coming between the ribs in order to access the area there. And for that, you'd pretty much have to come in through the right side, from what I understand. Now, the pressure difference is significant. These have quite a high pullout force on the order of 1.5 newtons each. So by the time you've put 10 or 15 of them around, you're more than able to resist the pressure that's involved there. Okay, well, I've described what we'd like to do, and now I'll describe some of the central problems with ultrasound guidance, and that's all the weird things you see when you put a rigid instrument into the middle of the heart. So ultrasound is great for soft tissue and blood, where most of the acoustic energy simply passes through. A little bit is reflected, that's what you detect. But if you put a hard object in there, nothing passes through. It's all scattered, it can be absorbed and re-radiated, and so on. So this image shows this situation. At the top is the ultrasound scan head, and then the blue is the image that you see. And in a water tank here, we've taken just a simple stainless steel rod, which is approximating an instrument. And that is right here, but it sure doesn't look like this picture over here. And I'll describe some of the artifacts. So here you can see the surface pretty well, and that's because the energy is propagating down. It's a nice normal incidence here. It's perpendicular to the direction, so it just bounces back and you see a bright echo. Over here in the rod, however, you've got a different angle. So now it's coming down here and it's bouncing off somewhere else, and the scan head never hears that echo. Meanwhile, some of the acoustic energy is absorbed into the rod, where it proceeds to rattle around and then reemerge every bounce, every reverberation. Now, the way ultrasound works is, of course, you send out a pulse and you wait for the echo and you time it, and assuming the speed of sound is known, then that tells you the distance to whatever produced that echo. Well, every time a reverberation comes out of here, another time delay has gone on, and so the machine decides that must be something that's farther away. So this set of lines here are the decreasing reverberations of that instrument. And then there are terrible things that happen at the tip. Anytime you have a large change in curvature, you tend to have strange artifacts. So we get a blob hanging off the tip here, some funny reverberation artifacts as well. So there's all sorts of problems with trying to image these objects. Now, we've tackled this and come up with some pretty good fixes. For instance, you can put a surface texture on. So instead of a nice, shiny, smooth surface, you now can make the surface rough. There's some problems with sterilization of this, of course, but it does a good job of scattering the energy so you don't have these funny problems with specular reflections. You can put coatings, plastic coatings on that help impedance match between the blood and the tissue. And of course, image processing and some interface techniques like the use of stereo visualization and haptic interfaces can help as well. But at the end of the day, we have put together enough of these pieces that we can successfully perform this fairly simple procedure in a beating heart. And here you see the instrument coming in. You see even with our nice coatings and all, it still looks blobby. And here's the patch holder, the circle you see here. And it's moving a little bit with the septum there between the atria. But because the atriums aren't the big pumps for the heart, there isn't a whole lot of motion there. So we're able to do that pretty well.
Question?
Yeah?
Is that a processed image in any way that's been cleaned up? Or is that the raw, image that the surgeons are seeing?
That would be the raw image that the surgeons are seeing. We can display this stereoscopically. And by the way, we made the mistake of showing the stereoscopic display to the guys we work with, who now insist on stereoscopic displays for every procedure they do. And the stereo helps a lot here, by the way, because these funny blobby artifacts are hard to sort out. However, if you get depth perception on top of them, that gives you a lot more spatial coherence to what you're seeing. And so it really does seem to make a big difference in this case. Okay, so we had nice success with that first simple procedure. On to the real challenges. And in particular, we're looking at mitral valve repair. So the function of the mitral valve here is to keep blood from flowing back from the ventricle into the atrium when it contracts. And what does that are a pair of little sort of diaphanous leaflets. And as soon as the blood starts to reverse, they're carried with the flow until they meet and they form a seal, which prevents the blood from regurgitating. Now, they don't seal sometimes for a lot of reasons. There are various heart disease processes which lead to dilation of the heart, for instance, where the leaflets used to meet like this. They now pull back so far that they don't seal correctly, and so there's a leak. There are also congenital issues. Something like 15% of females around age 20 have some regurgitation, heard as a heart murmur often. That seems to decrease with age, interestingly enough. And there are other things that happen. There are little chordae, you can't see too well in this picture, but little strings that run from the surfaces of these leaflets down towards the base of the heart, or the apex of the heart here. And those help hold the leaflets in position, just as parachute strings help to hold a parachute in position. And those can break or become elongated, again, by various processes. Or the leaflets themselves can distend. And the end of the day, the same thing happens. You get leaks. Now, there are a number of things that surgeons do to help repair this. They actually resect the leaflets, that is, they cut out extra tissue, do a bunch of things. One we're concentrating on is a very common repair procedure, and that's called annuloplasty. So the annulus is this ring around the top of the valve to which the two leaflets attach to the rest of the heart. And the idea here is that if the leaflets don't coapt correctly, by making that smaller, you can bring more of the leaflets into contact, and that means you'll get a better seal. And the way that's done is a procedure like this. First, some sutures are placed around that ring. Then the ring is attached to those sutures, and then the sutures are pulled down into position and tied off. So now you have a rigid ring that's a smaller diameter than the original size, and ideally now the leaflets will meet correctly. So the challenge for us is to figure out how to do this while the heart is still beating. So our strategy is similar to the atrial septal defect repair idea. Here we'll have an instrument we introduce to the left atrium. We'll bring the ring out from it, and likewise we'll have our anchor driver. We'll place it on top of the annulus and staple it into place, if you will. Now, ideally, if we can do this, this will eliminate the heart-lung machine, and it brings another interesting benefit as well. If it's possible to make this ring adjustable, for instance, if it's a semi-flexible ring with a drawstring in the middle, we can actually adjust the size of the annulus while the heart is beating by pulling on the string. And that way you might be able to optimize the function of the valve so you get just the right diameter to prevent regurgitation but allow the largest possible flow through the valve. Right now, that's done on a set-and-forget basis. The surgeon with the heart open, lacking blood, not beating, sews the ring into position, and then moves on. And you know, good surgeons are good at this. They often get an effective size, but it's not clear that it's optimum for a lot of patients. So, all sounds good. This is hard. First of all, this tissue is moving fast, and I'll show you just how fast in a minute. It's moving too fast for you to do this with manual instruments and try to compensate for that motion by hand. Well, this suggests that a robot might actually be useful in this context. So here's the outline for a system that might be able to do this, and this is also the outline for my talk today. Over here, this is a red blob is supposed to be the heart. We're inserting one of the instruments through it, and here's the annulus that's our target. Now we're visualizing what's happening in there with the 3D ultrasound, and those 3D volumes then go into a couple of pieces of software. One of them is a tissue tracker that tells us where the annulus is in each frame, and the other is an instrument tracker that gives us the relationship between the instrument and that annulus. We put both of those coordinates into a controller, and we call it a model predictive controller for reasons that will become clear, and then we use that to drive the motion compensation instrument. The idea here is that as the heart beats, the instrument now moves in synchrony, and the surgeon then just applies the manipulations they'd like on top of that. So we can present it to the surgeon as if the valve annulus is now fixed, and the instrument is now fixed, and they can work on this virtually still heart when in fact they're both moving back and forth at quite a high rate. Now, a number of people have looked at this sort of approach. The big application has been in coronary artery bypass grafting or CABG surgery. And the idea here is that blood vessels on the outside surface of the heart have become blocked, so new tubes are sutured into place to provide a blood supply for the heart muscle. And the groups who've looked at this have some advantages over what we're trying to do. One advantage is they can use things like high-speed cameras, so the very fast motion of the heart can be digitized on very short time scales. We're stuck with 3D ultrasound, so we get 25 or 30 volumes per second, and that's all. And furthermore, the precision requirements are rather different. These blood vessels are small, 2, 3, even 1 millimeter in diameter, so you need real precision in order to be able to suture those. We don't know yet, but we think a precision on the order of 1, 1.5 millimeters is probably adequate for us. So there's some substantial differences here between what we do and what they're trying to do. I'll mention a couple of other somewhat related areas. One is some work by Cam Revere here at CMU on tremor removal and microsurgery. The difference there is that he's trying to remove very high frequency artifacts from manually held instruments with fairly small amplitudes. We need big amplitudes, but at a somewhat smaller frequency, a lower frequency, and with substantially higher forces. And there's also the problem of respiratory cancellation in radiological tumor treatment. So you want to zap a tumor while someone's breathing with a beam of radioactive particles, and you need to account for the fact that they're breathing. This, in fact, is directly applicable since while the heart is beating, it's also being influenced by chest motion in the beating heart case. However, we have a big advantage in that during heart surgery, the patients are intubated, meaning a machine is doing their breathing for them, so we have, in some sense, perfect prediction of that particular motion, and it's not our problem here. Okay, on to the description of the work we're doing. Let me start with the tissue tracker in part one here. And the first thing you want to know about this tissue, this mitral annulus, is where is it going? And so we put some effort into characterizing this. Perhaps surprisingly, it hadn't been well characterized during heartbeat before. And the way we did that is we took normal subjects, normal volunteers, and made 3D ultrasound sequences of the valve as it moved around. And then we picked out in each slice of each frame the location of the annulus. Okay, this is a very tricky task. There's no good software way to do that, so we used the state-of-the-art technique, namely undergraduate students, in order to find those locations. And here are a couple of slices. And the fellow we had doing this, named Richard Plows, did a phenomenal job. He came up with a very reliable and repeatable algorithm so that he got a good characterization of this motion. And here's an example of one data set across the cardiac cycle. You can see the points along the annulus from the various slices, and then the point in the middle is the centroid moving around. And here's what we get. Now, the surprising and extremely pleasing result we came up with was if you characterize that motion, either the centroid or particular points on the annulus, as a function of time, you find out that they're almost linear. So if you do a principal component analysis, here are the components you get. One of them is moving in this sort of double peak pattern, which is pretty characteristic of heart motion in general. The other two components are quite small. So something like 80, 90, 90% plus of the motion can be accounted for by a single axis. So that's really nice. Here you can see on the 3D ultrasound image, this is just one slice, these are the leaflets flapping back and forth here as the valve opens and closes. These are the chordae coming off and going down to the apex of the heart. And in this light, it's hard to see. There are little red dots down here and a little blue dot here, which indicates the location of the annulus in each frame. And those dots are pretty much tracking along the straight lines shown here. So life is good. This says we really only have to worry about one axis. There'll be some slight off-axis motion, but we'll catch most of the motion with a single direction. The bad news is it's a pretty darn fast motion. We're talking about 210 millimeters per second and about 3.8 meters per second squared acceleration during this fast recoil. And you can see here, this is time in seconds. So in 100 milliseconds in this particular individual, it looks like the points on the annulus move close to 15 millimeters. So that's a pretty tricky tracking problem. OK. Well, let's talk about how we're going to track that with our instrument. And let me begin by talking about surgical instruments in general. Now, by and large, they tend to be long, thin tubes. And fortunately, there aren't many long, thin tubes in the heart on this size scale. So this says if we can find straight lines, we can probably find the instruments. And our approach is a projection approach. The idea is if I have a volume of tissue and I have an instrument in it, the instrument shaft tends to look very bright. Again, because it's a hard material, the ultrasound reflects strongly from it. So now if I take that volume and I project it, that is, I look into it, and I rotate it around until I'm lined up and I'm looking right along this, I will see an extremely bright spot in that projected image. And so by looking in all these different directions for the brightest spot, I can locate the axis. And that's exactly what we do here. So here's my instrument shaft in the volume. And I now look at the various projection directions here. If I look from the side, for instance, I see a bar. But if I look from the end, I see this crescent moon shape because all of the bright reflections are from the top surface, and it's substantially brighter than anything else I see there. Now, each one of these projections represents two angles, so it's a volume, so I need longitude and latitude, if you will. And then within that, I have two positions, so I have an x and a y coordinate. So I can think of that as it gives me 4 degrees of freedom of the instrument location. And that's right, that describes the equation of a line in space, for instance, is 4 parameters. Now, there are a lot of ways you might think about actually doing this. And the way we're doing it is in terms of a 2D radon transform, or equivalently, you can talk about a Huff transform. Or I should say we're doing a 3D version. The 2D radon transform says I can describe any line in a plane in terms of a distance from the origin to that line, a perpendicular distance, and in terms of an angle. And I can do that with this integral. So if I look in the image space, for instance, here are two bright lines. When I transform that, I get one spot that represents one of those lines, and I get another spot that represents another of those lines. Okay. Now, you need to generalize this into 3D. And this is the modified 3D radon transform, because if you just take the 2D equations, you do the obvious generalization, you wind up finding planes in 3D, and we want lines in 3D. So we use a slightly different formulation. The idea is pretty much the same as the 2D case. We pick a plane in space, and within that, we look for bright lines in that plane. So again, it's a projection operation. And then in order to perform this in the 3D volume, we need to work out a search algorithm that tells us how to find this. And we do this with sort of a variable scale approach. We start out with some sub-volumes, 32 voxel diameter. And then we do our projection in 10-degree increments on those. And based on those, we select candidates that have the brightest projection. Usually it's on the order of 5 or 10 that have bright spots in them. And then we look more closely. That is, we've done 10-degree searches. Now we do a refined search with 1-degree spacing. And then finally, just to confirm that the brightest spot is in fact the instrument, we have this template for the characteristic pattern we expect to see from the ultrasound reflecting off the top of the instrument. We correlate that, and then we pick the point with the brightest correlation as the instrument. And it works great in simulation. We then went and did some experimental validation. And once again, we used a water tank. Ultrasound only propagates through water or soft tissue. And we looked at a bunch of different instrument materials, different angles, and varying positions. And this is some typical data. This is a coated stainless steel rod. Again, we get much better performance if we use surface coatings. The coating in this case was duct tape, not exactly a surgical material, easily found to hand. Since then, we found rubber coatings that actually work just as well. But here's the true angle for the orientation of the, so we have ultrasound propagating from above. We change the orientation of the object, and you can see, of the instrument, and you can see we get excellent prediction there. Likewise, if we do our estimates in this direction, we get very nice agreement up to about this point, maybe 40 or 50 degrees, when things start to go south. And the reason is the ultrasound energy is propagating down, and at a large angle, most of it's getting sent off somewhere else. So this scheme works well as long as you're not too far off, but that's okay. That's the situation we anticipate in surgery. So the angular resolution is great. Positional, we have about the same thing. Each one of these bars represents a different material here. And you can see at low angles of incidence, especially for the good materials, we have errors on the order of a millimeter. You get out to the larger angles and you start to see rather larger errors. So we then proceeded to in vivo validation, and something you learn in the ultrasound world is nobody believes tank studies. And the reason is water is just too friendly. If in the real situation, the ultrasound has to first propagate through tissue, like the outside wall of the heart, or even worse, the chest wall, before going through the heart, then it goes through blood, which isn't a pure fluid, it's a suspension. And so those lovely algorithms that work perfectly in the tank didn't work at all in vivo. However, here, we got pretty good results. So this is actually three different sequences showing the instrument location. You can see if you can see it there. And there are the boxes drawn around the true location. And we've had, once we've tuned up the algorithm, we have nearly 100% success rate at locating the instrument within the images. Okay. Now, this is odd. Sorry about that. Strange. Okay. So, what I've told you about before is offline processing. We take a bunch of data, go back to the lab, grind on it, get our pretty results. That won't do it in the clinic. We need, during surgery, to get those results in real time. And by this projection approach, we're doing an awful lot of computation. By the time you add up all the different search pieces you need to do, there's something like 100,000 projections you have to do for each volume that comes through. The trick here is that that projection operation is exactly what graphics cards like to do. So this is the last generation of graphics cards. We now have the 8800. It's been out about 6 months, I think. And I believe it has 64 parallel processors. And it has all these nice built-in functions it's meant to do, which are really very close to the operations we need to do for the radon transform. So the result is we can take our algorithm, tune it up a little bit, do our coarse-defined search, and then we can easily get through this in a single frame interval. So we can identify the instrument location with no problem. Okay, so now in real time I'm able to find the axis of the instrument, but you'd like to know more than just its axis. You'd like to know the rotation angle. So if I have a gripper, for instance, I might care a lot if I can grip something this way as opposed to this way. And I also need to know the tip position, not just the axis, but where I am along that tip. And that one's particularly important because there tend to be ugly artifacts that float at the end of instruments. So the way we do that is we borrow a trick from Pierre DuPont and Jeff Stahl at Boston University, and we hang some markers on it. So I apologize for the dark image here. This is an instrument shaft, a coated instrument shaft, and on it are some rubber rings. This is a rubber spiral, which are attached to provide bright ultrasound reflections. Now, since we know how far they are from the tip, if we can identify these markers, then we can simply go forward the correct amount and we'll be right at the tip. This one, because it's a spiral, has a varying distance between this pair of markers and its location along the top edge. And by measuring that distance and comparing it to this fixed distance, we can get the roll angle for the instrument as well. And what we do then is we find the axis using the radon transform algorithm. We then take a slice through. Here's what the image looks like. Here are little markers. And then we just take the stereotypical pattern, correlate it along the top edge, and note when we get a blip for each one of those markers, and then we can go through and find the tip location and the roll angle. So here are some in vivo results once again. Here you can see, in fact, the mitral valve flapping. This is inside the atrium, and you'll see you get clear indications of the markers in this relatively early instantiation from about a year ago. Because the markers were close to the edge, we sometimes lost them, and you can see the tip has actually jumped down a notch here from where it ought to be. But we've improved the reliability of this in our more recent instantiations. So for imaging, we found ways to successfully track these instruments in real time using this combination of a radon transform and the tip markers. But we've learned a lot about building the right instrument, and that's absolutely crucial for getting good results here. OK, let me move on then and talk about the model predictive controller. So the idea here is I know where the tissue is from the ultrasound. I know where the instrument is from the ultrasound. Now I can close the loop around them so that my instrument stays the correct distance away as the valve moves. And we started out with tank trials. And in this case, we needed something that moved just as the heart moves. So we built a device like this. This is a platform on which we can mount various things. It moves back and forth. And it follows that pattern we observed for the human mitral valve motion. Now, I had an undergrad build this as a summer project. And I assumed the way to do this was with an electric motor and some sort of a lead screw or something. And he came back and said, no, I want to cut a cam that follows that pattern out of steel and then put a cam follower, and then it's guaranteed to follow this pattern. I thought, why not? It's a real mechanical engineering approach, but by gosh, it follows this pattern every single time. OK, now we suspend this right above our water tank, and then we put a little frame down, and we need a target to move inside the tank that we can track with ultrasound. Now, you might or might not have noticed when I talked about tissue tracking that I only got as far as characterizing the motion of the mitral valve annulus using manual segmentation. Now, I didn't tell you how we were going to track that tissue in real time because I'm not sure how we're going to track that in real time. Okay, that's a big challenge.
Just to be clear, when you're doing the tissue tracking, you pick the features yourself to track?
When we calculated this curve to find the classic motion for several subjects, we had Richard Plough spend his summer picking out points on slice after slice of ultrasound. So we have very good results for that, but it's not something you can do in real time during surgery. Okay. Now, we are developing techniques to do that. I will add that until now, no one's really had techniques for tracking tissue features in real time and volumetric medical data. That's an unsolved problem. We have techniques that can do the tracking. They don't run in real time, and they don't look friendly to graphics processor units. And we have techniques that run in real time, but they're not quite reliable enough. So this is an ongoing area of research. I'm happy to talk about that, but I don't think I'll have time today.
So we were wondering, why don't you use fiducials? Are you able to deploy them, and then you're done?
Yeah, fiducials are a good idea, and we tried that. The problem with fiducials and ultrasound is finding the right fiducial. So a single point fiducial, so for instance, we have our little anchors. We can place one of those. And often you can see them. And sometimes you can't. So the ultrasound data looks very noisy. It's got a lot of speckle noise associated with it. And so if you have a single point fiducial, It looks a lot like speckles sometimes. They're very hard to keep track of. Now, we've built extended fiducials, little lines, circles, various sorts. The trouble is now you have to attach them to a pretty delicate part of the heart and then remove it later. So it's certainly possible. We'd rather not. If we can do it with just image data, we'd prefer to do it that way. Yeah. Okay, so back to our tank setup. What do we use for tracking in the short term? Well, what we're good at tracking in real time are straight lines. So we built a target that looked like a pair of straight lines. These are a pair of strings, which are tied to this frame. And the tracking then consists of finding the equation of this line, the equation of this line, solving for the intersection, and tracking that spot. So that's the task we asked the controller to do. And then here's a picture of the setup. This is the frame. Here's the X down here in the water tank. Down here is the ultrasound scan head. It's actually in the water looking towards the target area. And then this is our instrument. It's one of those instruments with markers on the tip that I showed earlier. In this case, it passes through this little port, which simulates passing through the heart wall. And then the other end of this is connected to a small lab robot. So here's how it works, or doesn't work. So if you look closely, here's what you see in the tank. And here's what the ultrasound machine sees. Oh, and this is rotated because the ultrasound machine is looking this way, and we display the ultrasound from the scanner outward, so it's this way. And what you might see if you look long enough is that this X here is following this characteristic curve, and in fact, the instrument is following that characteristic curve too. It's just delayed by 50 to 100 milliseconds. So here's some of the data. The target is the black dashed line, and the instrument is the red line. And this delay, this 50 to 100 millisecond delay, is very bad news. It means that by the time the target has moved back and has started down, the instrument is in a completely different phase. And so instead of tracking the tissue, it's whacking into it pretty hard. OK, so how do you deal with that problem? And the problem is fundamental in some sense, because first of all, there's the delay for our image processing. And yes, we might hope to make that faster. But the physics of ultrasound imaging also take a toll here. You have to ping, wait for that acoustic pulse to go out to the tissue and propagate back to the scanner. And you have to do that along every line in the image. And the speed of sound is not very fast compared to the speed of light, certainly. And so it just takes a while to scan out the entire image. So even if we made instantaneous tracking possible, there would still be delays that wouldn't be acceptable here. So how can you do this? Well, this is a problem that people have started to look at in the CABG procedures, the coronary artery bypass grafting. And there are a few approaches. One is just template matching. So you've got electrocardiogram signals coming in. You can see when the heartbeat is going to occur from those signals electrically. And then you could just use that to cue up the motion you observed last time. And that works OK, except there's a problem with variability. So your heart doesn't beat at exactly the same interval every time, unless you have a pacemaker. It takes a little bit longer, a little bit shorter. And so that can cause big problems. Again, because of that very fast motion here during the recoil, small delays can have big consequences. Another approach is spectral modeling. Again, because the heart is periodic, it's pretty easy to model with a harmonic spectrum, and then you can simply adaptively fit those values. The problem is making this work so that it can track the variation in heart rate across time. Instead, we've picked an approach where we model the motion harmonics as time varying and then use an extended Kalman filter in order to implement that. So the model works something like this. We start out by assuming that we can use the usual Fourier series to describe the motion of the heart together with some offset, except we now make them variable. And we allow them to vary as a function of time, both the coefficients on the harmonic terms and also the offset. Now, if you look at the number of parameters in this model, if you're going to keep m turns to the harmonic, and remember, our data is coming in at 25 or 30 times a second. The fundamental heart rate is roughly 1 hertz, so it doesn't make sense to have too many harmonics there. So you need a fairly small number, something like 5 or 7. And then there are another pair of parameters as well. So our problem then is finding the parameters as a function of time to describe this kind of a model. And let's forego the math here for the extended Kalman filter. The usual idea applies, though. We have some current state estimate and a state transition matrix that we've built up through essentially historical data. We come up with a predicted state, and then from the predicted measurement, which is what we use in our control, this is where we think things are going to go, we then take the new measurement, compare them, use our Kalman gains, and come up with a new state estimate and go around the loop again every time we get a new sample. Here are results from simulation. Again, this is a long time sequence of observed heart motion. And we can compare several different techniques that we've implemented. The template method here, where we just say, I'm going to assume this one looks like the last cycle, is pretty messy. You can see we get a lot of error here due to the variability. Oh, and by the way, these are all at a fixed rate. This doesn't even include the heart rate variability. Then there are the spectral methods, autoregressive and fading autoregressive filters. The problem with them is that they tend to lock on to a single average trajectory, and so the details can't really be adapted as time goes by. However, our extended Kalman filter here, the quasi-periodic method, is able to respond to these changes. And you can see we get much better agreement cycle to cycle than these other methods.
Question?
Yeah.
It seems to me the goal isn't agreement, because the cost is asymmetric. Punching through the wall or the valve is not a good idea, but missing it is not so bad.
It's a good point. And you would want to bias these filters to underestimate. One issue that we haven't looked into yet is the compliance of the valve annulus. So it's soft tissue, supported by fluid to a good extent. It may be there's enough compliance there, we don't have to worry about that. But yes, you're right, it could be important to put in an asymmetry there and always underestimate and never overestimate the position. Okay, so here are some results. And you'll recall the last case we showed where we were constantly banging into the target. Here you could see with a fixed rate we were doing a great job of keeping up with it. Now we have a variable rate, and you can see the rate here. So what we did was we took clinical data. There are large databases available on the web of the heartbeat-to-heartbeat interval for a large number of subjects, both healthy and pathological. And we took that data, and we put those intervals into our heart rate simulator and had it speed up or slow down in order to compare to that. And as you could see there, let's see if I can get it to play again in the later part of this, it does a pretty good job. It's not as clean as here, where we're keeping up pretty well. In the variable case, if you watch it, there's more jitter. There's definitely more error than in the fixed case. However, again, the performance is far better than the other techniques we've looked at for doing this. Right now, we have RMS errors of something like 1.5 millimeters, which we think we can improve as we do a better job with some aspects of the image processing. OK, the last thing I want to talk about is a sort of hot off the presses. This is a new instrument we've built that will take that motion compensation signal and actually follow the motions here. And it will also allow for the surgeon's motions to be superimposed on top of this. And this is a simple handheld device with a single motor that moves in a single degree of freedom. So here's the motor coil and motor magnet. This is just a linear electromagnetic motor. It moves this carriage back and forth. There's a linear ball slide here. So the tip of this just moves in a straight line. Now, because we use one of these nice linear motors, the dynamics are really clean. There's almost no friction. The mass is relatively low, so we get very high accelerations and very nice fidelity. For sensing right now, we're just using a simple linear potentiometer here in this case. And we get excellent performance just using a PID loop. We get a 3 dB point of over 20 hertz, and our velocity and acceleration are higher than we need to track the mitral. So it works well. This is, and then here's the handle the surgeon can hold on to. And I think this is a great example of making almost mechatronic devices. It's not clear you'd even call this a robot, but something that is simple enough to do a lot of good. It's not like trying to build a complicated 6 or 7 degree of freedom robot to work inside the heart at these very high speeds, which would be very challenging and very hard to make safe. But it appears to do the job in this case in that it can keep up with the rates you need. And this sort of approach is something that Paulo Dario calls Black and Decker for surgeons. And I think there's a lot of leverage for this kind of device in surgery. OK, so here's an example of some bench tests we did to see if this idea was going to work. We hooked up our heartbeat simulator again. And we put on the end of our instrument just a ballpoint pen. And we asked people to draw a circle between two lines, basically here. And you can see what happened. We were just punching through with no servoing. In this case now, you'll see the instrument is servoing the pen at the same rate here. And after a little bit of adjustment for the first contact point or two, the user figures it out and can start drawing pretty effectively around that circle. Now, in these user studies, we use two performance metrics. One is dexterity, that is, how much of the circle, what percent of the circle were they between the two target lines? So this mark outside here wouldn't count, but these two marks here would. And this might be a 50% result. And the other is the force that's applied. So just behind the ballpoint pen here, we have a force sensor that tells us how high the contact forces were. And among the results are these. So if we just compare the solid tool case, where we're not servoing, it's just a rigid instrument, to the case where we're servoing, we see we get something like a 50% increase in performance in terms of the simple dexterity measure. Force sensing, we also see good results. So this is a histogram. The horizontal axis is the size of the force sample that we took during the experiment. And the vertical axis is the amount of time spent at that force level. Or you could think of this as the number of samples at that force level. So if you spend time at high forces, like here, as with the solid tool, you get big bars out to the high forces. The red bars here are for the motion compensating tool, motion compensating instrument. And you can see you spend all your time at lower force levels. And in fact, the 90th percentile for those samples is about half with motion compensation that it would be with the solid instrument. So this is pretty good evidence that this does a good job of improving performance. OK, so that brings me to the conclusion. Let me summarize by describing what I see as the system that we need to put together now to make it all work for in vivo trials. So we have our 3D ultrasound machine that's imaging the mitral annulus. Our volumes come off and they're delayed. And that delay is very important to compensate for. So we have our instrument tracker that works fine and our tissue tracker that we're working on. Both of those go into this model predictive controller that will include this extended Kalman filter to do the look-ahead estimation. Now, that will tell the actuator how to move, but that actuator effort we probably want to feed back, for instance, to the instrument tracker so that it can do a better job of predicting where things are going to go next time. Meanwhile, that comes up to our 1 degree of freedom motion compensation instrument, and we're also looking into improving the performance by taking advantage of these extra signals. So, for instance, right now, we don't use the ECG signal, it's coming off the heart. It's there, it's constantly monitored during surgery, and we can probably use that to enhance the performance of the tissue tracker to more or less predict where the heart, when the heart is going to beat and where it's likely to be next time. The same is true with controlled respiration when we go into in vivo trials. We'll need to keep track of that additional motion, which can be a centimeter or more, and feed that into the tissue tracking and thus the instrument tracker as well. So there are still large pieces of this yet to do, but I think at this point we're fairly confident that we can, in fact, put together the pieces we need in order to perform these fairly complicated repair procedures inside the beating heart using only ultrasound for guidance. So let me conclude then with an acknowledgement. This is part of a large project in Boston involving collaboration between heart surgeons, engineers, industry, and folks in my own lab, and I want to mention Paul Novotny, who did the work on the instrument tracking algorithm, Shelton Nguyen, the extended Kalman filter, and Dan Kettler, who built the motion compensating instruments. So thank you for your attention.
So
great work and a great talk. One question. You spent a lot of time talking about all the effort you went to see the instrument. And the whole time I was thinking, well, it doesn't have to be a passive target. You could make it an active transmitter or even a transponder.
Hey, you're telling me I shouldn't have done the one piece that worked really well? Yes, and you know, we looked into that, and the guys from Philips, we've talked to a lot about various kinds of ultrasound beacons. So you could have an active beacon that pinged, and you could listen for it with the scanner, or you could have a receiver, and the scanner pings, and you can listen with the beacon, and you can do all that. You're going to make the system more complicated. Now you've got another, well, and furthermore, you have to redesign the ultrasound system. And that's not trivial either. But we can do that piece. That's the part that works. So I think if you can do it based on image data, life is good. And it's well worth sticking with that. Yeah. Questions, George?
I used to work with 3D ultrasound.
Uh-oh.
And at Duke, machine with Philips, based in and we always talked about if we wanted to go faster, why do we bother interrogating the entire area? Why don't we just interrogate and track the things that we're trying to interrogate? You can get a 10 and faster fold increase in the rate of imaging for 200 frames per second. That
would sure.
Again, you need to be inside the machine to do that.
Yes. And yes, that's something we're certainly looking into. There are a number of other intracardiac applications you can imagine looking at besides the two I talked about today. And for some of those, where there's more complicated motion, you know, here we're lucky, it's pretty much in a single axis. There, I think you'd almost certainly have to do that in order to get the full 3D trajectories to work. So yeah, it's a great idea, certainly something we'll have to contend with.
Now, you've done this all on the single axis. When you had the errors in the other axis, you had how much error in the other axis? Because it seems that if you're coming up in ever with the instrument that's not aligned with the beating of the heart, you're going to have some issues.
Darn, you weren't supposed to notice those other axes. Yes. Again, this is an open question about how much compliance there is in the annulus. So if the annulus is relatively compliant, then the fact that it moves side to side about a millimeter, roughly a millimeter in those traces, it may not matter. So from the surgeon's point of view, we'll stabilize the image, we'll stabilize the instrument, and you know they'll see things moving around the periphery, but the actual annulus they're working on will just be moving a millimeter or so. Now, if we can bring up our anchoring device and hold that still, then we win. If that motion is too stiff, the annulus is too stiff, the motion's too strong, we'll have to think of other choices. I mean, one obvious thing to do is to make the instrument compliant. So you make it out of shape memory alloy, for instance, and now it comes down and touches the tissue and it tracks the tissue for you in a passive way. And we even looked at that for the normal direction, but there's just no way to put that kind of compliance in and have reasonable forces, it appeared, since it's too far too fast.
Yeah. It seemed, unless I missed something, your work was based on the normal motion of the heart, but you're going to be fixing hearts with diseased valves and they're not going to have normal motion. Was that the last part that you got at in terms of?
No. It's, again, another problem we need to address. Certainly, the surgeons assure us that this motion appears to fit a good fraction of patients. Now, it may not fit all patients, so this procedure may not apply to the entire patient population. But certainly, if we can spare a large fraction from use of the heart-lung machine and so on, you know, that would be a good thing, even though there'll be a fraction of very diseased hearts, for instance, which move in funny ways that we just can't address. But that you can evaluate preoperatively with an echo study, and you can tell whether this person's a candidate or not for the beating heart approach.
Congratulations for important work, and I know Pedro Delillo very well. As you know, he was in Pittsburgh for many years, and I trained under him, so you're very lucky with his insight. So I know some of the work was published, and it's using basically the arms of the Da Vinci robot inside the right atrium, and then visualizing them inside the beating heart. However, what you're describing is inside the left atrium now, and there's all new sets of challenges there. So my question is on the effector tools. your imaging work seems to be coupled with some delivery systems for these anchors, provided that is what you're trying to do, that seems to cry for a dedicated system.
Yes, okay, so let me start with the da Vinci in the heart. I'm not aware of anybody using the da Vinci in the heart while it's beating. So there's a lot of work in doing intracardiac procedures with the da Vinci, but the heart is always stopped and they use the heart-lung machine, to my understanding. I've had discussions with the guys at Intuitive Surgical about whether you could use their instruments. One problem, which we actually discovered in one of our first animal procedures, is that you insert an instrument into the heart, and even if you think it's pretty well sealed, there may be blood leaking up into the mechanism. So they do not have instruments now that are sealed against the intracardiac pressure. So you'd be driving blood up into their robot. So it's not that that couldn't be fixed, but it would be a project to make that work. In terms of the instrumentation for this, yes, I think the current generation of surgical robots, including the ones that I've seen in the research side, aren't really suitable for doing this. And so that's why, for instance, this motion compensating instrument seems like a big win. It's got the necessary bandwidth that the more versatile robots lack, but it's simple enough that you can hope to develop it and even use it inside the heart. And safety is an issue we haven't really even begun to address yet. It's obviously of paramount importance, and it's going to be a big challenge when you've got a fast, powerful actuator working inside the heart. So that's going to be a big headache before we can do anything clinically with this device. Did I address your question there? Okay, good.
Yeah. On tracking the instrument, can you, for example, track the part of the instrument which is outside of the patient's body?
Like yes.
Like in the camera or something?
Yeah, or electromagnetic tracking, or optically. Yeah, there are a lot of ways of doing that. What you need at the end of the day, though, is the relationship between the instrument and the tissue. So you can keep track of the instrument a lot of ways, but I need to know where the instrument is compared to that annulus. So I need to pull them both out of the ultrasound data, end of the day. Yeah, we get lucky is really the bottom line. It appears so far that the annular motion is mostly along the long axis of the left side of the heart. So that means we can come straight in from the left ventricle, right through the left atrium and get there. Now, we've also got a preliminary design for a motion compensating instrument with a bent shaft. So it would be a bent tube that then has more or less a stiff cable in it that would do the actuation for us. So we think we can more or less orient that direction of motion where we need it to go, although we haven't built that yet.
A couple of questions. First of all, related to the previous two, back on the slide where you showed your local coordinate system superimposed over the ultrasound, the two major axes at the two different locations were distinctly not parallel. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, over the entire perimeter, what kind of a, do you have basically a conic or cone form from?
Yeah, well, the nice thing about that, I can try to skip back to the image, I guess. And I'm going to wind up with problems with loading movies if I do that. Let's see. The nice thing about the way those images looked, if I can get to them somewhere here. Where are they? Oops, I passed them. That's it.
Yes.
Okay, so this is the ventricle, here's the atrium. If you're gonna come in, you're gonna come in from up here. So life is good. It looks like we'll be coming in. You could use a single port then for both sides here.
Okay, so you basically have a single vertex from which you're going to be going straight down the axis.
We think so. Again, we haven't fully characterized that, but the data we've seen suggest that it's all pretty much in the right direction for us to come in from above, from the top of the left atrium.
So my other question then was, in terms of tracking the tissue, Is your current strategy basically to use the fastest available method that works and just wait for computing to catch up? Any other strategies there that you're working on?
Procrastination counts. No, this is actually a pretty hot area, and if we wait, somebody else will beat us. So no, we're working quite hard on figuring out how to do that. We have a couple of promising approaches. I think, you know, fingers crossed, the next few months we'll come up with something that'll work. So, yeah. And back.
What is the role of the ultrasound probes? So there should be some developments in the ultrasound probe itself, so that maybe half your job. Is in the Philips slide there are some reports for
development? Oh yeah, we're always asking for new things. So let's see what I can describe about that. So just recently, past few months, Philips has announced a new probe, a transesophageal three-dimensional probe. So it happens that the esophagus passes right behind the heart, and it's been a traditional technique for years to use with two-dimensional probes that particular approach to get very good images of the heart. The problem is, if you bring the probe up externally to the thorax or into the ribs, you have to go through a lot of tissue, and that aberrates the beam, and you get blurry images. On the other hand, if you can come down and image through the esophagus where it's touching the heart, you get much, much nicer images. So that development alone has really upped the quality of the images we get. Now, this is a new technology. The first commercial real-time 3D ultrasound scanner is maybe 4 or 5 years old. And there's already been a new generation out that has roughly twice the resolution as of about a year or so ago. So yes, this is continuing to improve. And one of the things we're wondering is, are these problems we're solving on image processing, especially as far as tissue tracking goes, going to go away? As the imaging gets better, the quality of the signal processing you need goes down. It just becomes an easier problem. So aside from waiting for the compute power to get faster, we maybe should just wait for Philips to build a better ultrasound machine.
I have a quick question on the, or maybe one more. Well, I have two quick thoughts.
Okay.
One is, you could deliver a probe through your stuff and get it right up close to what you want to measure. I don't know if that helps or not. The second is, this situation cries out for putting something on that tissue, maybe a sleeve into the valve, or something that gives you a reference, potentially a mechanical bracing that allows you to do what you want, and then you pull it out later. You know, or you know, landing something somewhere or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Again, it's not an easy environment to work in. Remember, the walls are contracting and beating. And in the atrium, they're not moving a lot, but they're moving and they need to move. So that's tricky to deal with. The ability through these small ports to deploy something and then retrieve it, another real challenge. And again, I think it's looking pretty promising now that we can do it the hard way, that we can do it with image processing alone. So if we can, then we don't need to build fixtures and jigs and all these things that are going to be a major development effort on their own as well.
Yeah. Good question. So is there anybody working on, I mean, all these issues are because you're trying to enter to this beating heart from outside. Is there any way to put a robot, a miniature or whatever, on the beating heart itself so that you will at least have it in the same frame of motion?
Ooh, but it's differential motion.
This is differential.
Yeah, so it isn't like the whole heart is shifting as a rigid body. It's contracting, it's twisting. There's no fixed frame of reference within the heart itself.
On the outside also, if you put in a device, it will...
It'll move relative to any other point on the heart. So it's very hard.
So as a follow-up to Ben's point, why don't we take Cam and Marco's Heartlander, stick it to the heart, and then as
yeah,
you
stick
move
it
around,
you
move around the surface of the heart and move with you as you need it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting approach. The first thought, though, is the forces that you need are pretty high. So you're driving anchors that require newtons of force in a dynamic environment.
So I realize you're playing games, but can Heartlander carry something that's easily visualizable from the perspective from inside the heart that you can use as a visual?
Sure. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, so thanks very much again. Is it very quick?
Yeah.
Okay.
Most of the images you've shown are 2D images.
This one is, yes.
Right. With 3D, even with the TE, they're putting four wedges together, and that requires acquisition over four cardiac cycles. It's not really real time. Can you get the whole mitral valve in one of those thin slices?
Yeah. So notice the size of this. So there, you're talking about two different modes in the Philips machine. One's a full volume mode, they call it, where they take four quadrants and stitch them back together to show the cardiologist, and that's great for diagnosis. There's also a real-time mode, which gives you just one of those cones. You'll notice it's a narrow cone here, and that you get in real time. So,
get the whole annulus, right?
Well, it depends on where you put the probe, how far back you put it. So if you get a standoff or you come in through the apex of the heart, then you're far enough off that you can probably see the whole thing.
So, sounds good. Thanks very much again.
Thank you.